Oh, society is in upheaval around this, but I want to talk to you about how to outlast the gay revolution.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Wednesday on The Line of Fire. We often focus on worldview, Worldview Wednesday, moral and cultural issues. 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. But that being said, I will take your calls on anything you want to talk to me about today. If you've got a Bible-related question, a theology-related question, a culture-related question, I'll take your calls right here on The Line of Fire, your listener-sponsored voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. I also want to give you words of courage, words of hope, words of faith, and explain how we are to live as followers of Jesus in the midst of cultural decline. How we are to live as followers of Jesus when the darkness seems to be encroaching, when moral sanity seems to be leaving, when clear common sense issues seem to not be so clear anymore. How do we live? How do we function? What's our role? And how can we ultimately see the ways of God triumph in the earth? Unless Jesus comes first, how can we see the tide turn in America? Yes, video number six, the undercover videos exposing Planned Parenthood. Video number six has been released. Somewhere in the course of 2 hours to follow, I will play some of those clips for you. But the latest video indicates that baby parts were sold without parental knowledge or consent. So the mothers who agreed to have their babies aborted, to abort their babies, did not consent to the baby parts being used, quote, fetal tissue, products of conception being sold for medical research, and yet it was done anyway. A more damning evidence against the barbarous practices of Planned Parenthood. We'll talk about that as well. And yesterday, got a text message from a publicist with Bishop T.D. Jakes' ministry. I'd reached out to her, and she wrote back with a statement from Bishop Jakes that reinforces his absolute view that marriage is the union of one man, one woman, period, that all sexual acts outside of marriage are sinful, including but not limited to homosexual practice, and that this is not up to him to decide. The Word of God is very clear on that. Glad to see that. I was disappointed that there was defensiveness in the statement, as if the many sincere viewers of the video of the Huffington Post interview that he did, the very sincere viewers of that video, which includes me, that somehow we were just critics or it was our fault for misunderstanding. Many were deeply troubled by what was said. But I really appreciate the clarity. I really appreciate him not stepping back in any way. And he realizes how saying that his views are evolved or evolved and evolving could easily be misunderstood. That does not mean, by the way, that I agree with all of his theology. And of course, it's a terrible disappointment to me that he would be someone who wanted to see President Obama elected, given the president's militant stance on key moral issues. Nonetheless, we sent out that statement via Facebook and Twitter as widely as we could. And I'm thinking of writing an article about this tonight. Joey, tell me what you think. Tell me what you think, Joey. I'm thinking of writing an article tonight on Oprah Winfrey, T.D. Jakes, Joel Osteen, and homophobia. You say, what? Well, Oprah has been accused, as much as he's a champion of gay rights and a dear friend of gay activist leaders and celebrities, that because she allows T.D. Jakes and Joel Osteen on her show, and they have said on her network that they believe homosexual practice is sinful, that she's catering to homophobia. Yeah, I got some thoughts on that. We come back, I want to give you an edifying statement that will stir your hearts.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. Coming your way live from Sioux City, Iowa. I wrote the book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, with a real burden from the Lord to write it. I wrote it with a sense of vision, with a sense of purpose, with a sense of hope, but with a real burden to write the book. And I felt convinced that believers in America needed courage, needed hope, because the feeling is we've lost the culture wars. The feeling is the ship has sailed. It's too late to bring about change. Excuse me. It's time to throw in the towel. Well, I categorically differ with that. I categorically differ with that mindset. I'm not just being stubborn. I am not just refusing to face reality. I'm not sticking my head in the ground. I'm a believer. I'm a child of God. That means I take hold of the highest reality of all, and that is the truth about God and His Word. I am also an observer of society. I'm an observer of society. I look around at what's happening in the world. I look at history. I look at biblical principles. And based on that, I wrote the book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, where homosexual activism is really going and how to turn the tide. And I lay out 8 principles in the book. And my premise is this, that gay activism has within itself the seeds of self-destruction, and that those who live by biblical godly principles will outlast the gay revolution. Unless Jesus comes first, we will live to see the tide turn. The first chapter of the book lays out the day the line was crossed. And I talk about gay activism going too far. You see, that's a common thing that happens, that the goalposts keep moving, things keep going further, to the point of the lesbian mayor of Houston issuing subpoenas for pastors in the city. 5 pastors saying, I want every email, every private public communication, anything you have, sermons, notes, with any reference to homosexuality, because I'm differing with the stand you're trying to take in the city here on political and moral issues. It was an outrage. It was overreach. Leading attorneys and legal officials in America said absolute overreach the day the line was crossed. And then I begin to lay out 8 principles for long-term cultural change. And the first is this. Principle number 1, never compromise your convictions. Billy Graham said, courage is contagious. When a brave man takes a stand, the spines of others are often stiffened. Courage is contagious. Winston Churchill, October 29, 1941, had returned to his old school, Harrow, just 10 months after his previous visit. And things looked terribly bleak then for England in the midst of World War II. So he gave his famous Never Give In speech, not to soldiers, but to students. And he said this, you cannot tell from appearances how things will go. Just because things appear a certain way today, you cannot tell from appearances how things will go. He said, for everyone, surely, what we have gone through in this period, I'm addressing myself to the school, surely from this period of 10 months, this is the lesson. Never give in. Never give in. Never, 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 never. And nothing great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense. Now here's the challenge. He was talking about fighting the Nazis. Those were the opponents that he was dealing with in England. We're not in the physical war. We're in an ideological war. And our opponents are not Nazis, but family members, friends, co-workers, neighbors who identify as LGBT, who simply want to normalize homosexuality and just want, quote, the same rights that we have. So How do we stand strong in the midst of the cultural onslaught today? I go through in this chapter the various bullying attempts of gay activists to silence believers and people of conviction. And you see, here's what's happened. Those who used to be bullied, and I'm sure in certain situations still are, have become the bullies. This is a way that gay activism defeats itself. Those who used to be bullied have become the bullies. So I have a list of you shall nots in this book. You shall not receive professional counseling if you're a minor with unwanted same-sex attraction. You shall not have an opinion. How dare you give an opinion that's contrary to political correctness if you're a public figure? You shall not sign a petition. If it goes contrary to gay activism, you're going to pay for it. You shall not donate to a family cause. You shall not practice law. You shall not adopt. You shall not dissent. You shall not debate. On and on. In other words, gay activists have gone so far that little by little, believers are waking up and recognizing that we must take a stand. But how do we take it? Principle number two, take the highest moral ground. Paul said it in Romans 12:21, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Dr. Martin Luther King said, returning hate for hate multiplies hate, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. We are going to overcome the hatred of the world through love. We are going to overcome the darkness of the world through being light. We're going to overcome evil, wherever it is, with good. We're going to overcome the power of the flesh by the power of the Spirit. That's what I lay out in the second principle and expose where the real hatred and the real ugliness is coming from. Principle number three, sexual purity trumps sexual anarchy. And I demonstrate in this chapter with polls, with data, it's very, very clear, it's hard to deny or argue against, that the embrace of homosexuality in our culture today is not due to greater tolerance, but to less morality. It's not due so much to us being more tolerant, although that's part of it. It is primarily due to us being less moral when it comes to sexuality. So that the same society that's embracing homosexuality is also embracing cohabitation, is also embracing kids born out of wedlock, is also embracing polyamory, is also embracing the swingers culture, is also part of the same culture with all kinds of new dating TV shows and on and on and on, and celebration of pornography and strippers and you name it. It's undeniable. And those that oppose the normalizing of homosexuality also have higher standards in these other categories as well. The bad news is we are increasingly going the way of sexual anarchy. The good news is sexual purity trumps sexual anarchy. That as we grow and repent of our own sin and get our own houses in order in the church, that we will shine like lights, whereas sexual anarchy is not the way to have a healthy, growing society. Principle number four, refuse to redefine marriage. G.K. Chesterton said, don't ever take a fence down until you know the reason it was put up. Once you redefine marriage, you render it meaningless. Once the number two does not signify a man and a woman, the number two becomes arbitrary. It could just as well be three, or you could marry yourself, or it could be five or eight. And if your memes or if your little sayings are love wins or marriage equality for all, or I have the right to marry the one I love, then how can you limit it to two people? How can you even tell two adult brothers that they can't hook up and, quote, get married? So we must refuse to redefine marriage, and it's been proven through anthropological studies that societies based on solid marriage and family are the ones that endure. So if we live by this, then we can endure. We can, in that sense, be the last man standing. And then principle number five, celebrate gender distinctions. Celebrate gender distinctions. I've got an article that'll be coming out tonight. And it's on the subject of the University of California. All of their campuses, when you enroll, you can pick from six different gender identities. Male, trans female, gender queer slash gender nonconforming. And if that's not enough, category six, different identity. Target has now said from all their stores, they're going to remove the signs of gender. You go to the toys, it's not going to be boys' toys, girls' toys, because that's making gender distinctions. People don't like that. You cannot thrive as a society when you demolish and do war against the gender binary, as it's called negatively, male, female distinctive. That's what makes the world go round. So it's going to get crazy for a while, but ultimately sanity will prevail. Principle number six, keep propagating the truth until the lies are exposed. Many of the most fundamental teachings or maxims of gay activism, 1 in 10 is gay, gay is the new black, different things like that, they're based on falsehood. They're based on falsehood. We're going to keep propagating the truth until the lies are dispelled. And number seven, factor in the God factor. Time Magazine, April 1966, Is God Dead? Time Magazine, June 1971, The Jesus Revolution. You never know what God will do. Principle number eight, be determined to write the last chapter of the book. We're in this for the long haul.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to The Line of Fire. Michael Brown coming away live from Sioux City, Iowa. Number to call to get involved in today's conversation, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Any question you want to ask me, any issue you want to raise, we'll take some extra calls today as we're able to. And if you have a question, comment on my newest book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, that would be just great. I noticed someone posted on Facebook last night a call for bogus negative comments. In other words, he said he just mocked me, hadn't read the book, didn't plan on it, but just planned to mock me, and then asking others to post negative reviews and things like that. So that junk happens. We don't ask you to post dishonest, favorable reviews. In other words, we don't say, go to Amazon, even without reading the book, just because you're like me, and post a 5-star review. No, we say, read the book, and as you've read the book, post an honest review, and hopefully you'll like the book and be blessed by it and be stirred and be helped by it. But we're hearing from readers that they're getting hope and they're getting courage and they're getting faith. And you see, the bad news is the good news. You've heard me say it before, but I want to say it again. The bad news is the good news. Yeah, I find it very sad that Bruce Jenner has become this celebrity figure known as Caitlyn and is on reality TV. And however many people are cheering him on and saying that's courageous, I feel very bad for him. Yes, I continue to refer to him as him. I have no reason not to. No evidence that he is not him, no matter what he presently perceives himself to be or whatever hormones he's on or sex change surgery. I find it all very sad. I find it sad that Target wants to do war on gender. I find it sad that the University of California saying that incoming students can identify as male, trans female, gender, queer/gender nonconforming, or different identity. Can you imagine what's going to be filled out in that category? Can you imagine impressionable 18-year-olds who've been raised watching Glee, who've been raised with the celebration of, quote, Caitlyn Jenner, who've been raised with new dating shows and shows on polyamory and polygamy and all other kinds of things that challenge what marriage is, what family is, what gender is. Can you imagine what identity some of them are going to put down? And I documented in my book that National Public Radio had an interview a couple years back talking about those who are on the cutting edge of gender identity, and the young people in particular, they're thinking so outside the box, they're rebelling against the dominant culture and things like that. And they are going as far as saying, I don't want to be called he or her. I don't want to be called male or female. Just call me Tractor. Literally, I wonder what some of these confused kids are going to put down. I don't minimize the struggles of those who believe they're trapped in the wrong body. Why would someone ask for that? Why would someone want that? I don't minimize that. I don't believe that in many, many cases it has anything to do with sexual attraction. There are other issues that are going on. I understand that a little 3-year-old kid is hardly a gay activist when that little kid wants to be, you know, do the opposite of his gender identity. thinks he's a boy trapped in a girl's body, or 5 years old and says, I am a girl, I am a girl, and he's a boy. I don't minimize that. Of course not. God forbid. And I recognize there are some who are born with ambiguous genitalia, who are born intersex, who are born with chromosomal disorders. According to everything we know, that's not the case with Bruce Jenner. But the bad news is the good news. And I lay it out in Outlasting the Gay Revolution. You cannot maintain a healthy society long term and do war on the foundations of human civilization. Male-female distinctives are what makes the world go round. Male-female relationships, families, children. This is what makes the world go around. And you do war on gender. You want gender-neutral bathrooms and gender-neutral locker rooms and on and on and on. How in the world do you think you're going to maintain that long-term? And how far does it go? What the University of California is basically doing is saying, we are going to change our reality to cater to your perception. How can you function like that? If perception is reality, then there is no limit to how far it can go. The good news is that God's ways are ways of life, that God did make us male and female. Yeah, I understand. There are some that biologically and chromosomally have abnormalities. We don't celebrate that. We look at that as a loss. We look at that as a handicap, and we try to help people compassionately. I mean, it makes no sense to me if someone said I was diagnosed with gender dysphoria, and that's the technical word for someone believing they're in the wrong body. If someone says I was diagnosed with that, and here's the treatment for it, well, then why are you celebrating something? Now, celebrating the new identity, rather than saying, okay, I have an issue here, I need help. One thing to call for compassion is another thing to want to be celebrated. But I do know that those of us who live by God's principles, that those of us who don't disdain male-female distinctives, those of us who honor the way God created us rather than rebel against it or think it's some constricting, terrible straitjacket, those of us who do that will prevail in terms of this is just the way the human race works. Look, you put a 5-year-old behind the wheel of a car, you're going to have all kinds of accidents. You put a 20-year-old as the president of the United States, you're going to have all kinds of problems. You make an 8-year-old the head of the household, you're going to have difficulties. In other words, there are just certain things work certain ways because this is how human beings grow and mature and experience life. Well, male-female distinctives are at the very heart of it. Again, when you read Outlasting the Gay Revolution, when you start going through the data in that, I mean, you'll be in a state of shock. And I'm not predicting. I'm just saying this is what's happening. But you'll be encouraged because you realize, okay, this can't last long term. If Jesus doesn't come first, this has to defeat itself. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. Quick note. It does seem that a lot of polls are indicating that Donald Trump did take a hit after the debate. I talked about it yesterday. It seems some polls are saying the opposite, but that's what I would have expected, although he's still going strong. We shall see what happens with that. But to order your copy of Outlasting the Gay Revolution, it's a beautiful hardcover, almost 300 pages. When you order it through the Line of Fire, this is exclusive with us, we'll send you with it a free DVD of my 2-hour debate with Rabbi Shmuley, America's most famous rabbi. Is homosexuality America's greatest moral crisis? Eye-opening debate. You get that free on DVD to watch, along with the book, $30 postage paid. Give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH. No, wrong number. 1-800-278-9978. Sorry about that. 1-800-278-9978. For more info, go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. You can order straight from there. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire. A little later in the broadcast, I am going to get into some of the Planned Parenthood videos, some clips from there. Again, this is a providential event that is taking place in our lifetimes. Planned Parenthood being exposed in an unprecedented way. May it be fully exposed. May light shine. May more doctors or more nurses or more abortion clinic workers come forward with stories. May it be impossible to defend Planned Parenthood. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll go to the phones in Howard County, Maryland. Tim, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you very much. I listen to you every time, every chance I get, which is almost every day. And I think you're extremely wise and spot on everything you're talking about today. I actually had a question of a different nature.
Yeah, that's fine. We're good.
I always thought that Cain and Abel were young men when Cain slew Abel. I can't find any reference to Abel's age, but it looks like from what I'm finding was Cain actually 120 years old when he killed Abel?
No, there's no way.
That's what I'm getting from one source anyway.
No, there's no way that you can date that. Genesis 4 and 5 don't give us sufficient information to do that. We know that they're grown men. We know that they are working either field or whatever they're doing with flocks. So, you know, they have their own possessions in that respect. The only thing that the Hebrew tells us is in verse 3, and I just want to take a look at different translations here, verse 3. King James, New King James, in the process of time, New American Standard, it came about in the course of time, ESV, the course of time. That's how most translate it, the course of time. Okay. Your English translation at the designated time, NLT, when it was time for harvest. The Hebrew, though, is interesting. It's miketz yamim, which is literally at the end of days. But it doesn't mean the end of days like Jesus returning at the end of the age. What it means is after a period of time. Now, that could have been 30 years, or it could be talking about just at a certain time, harvest time, an appointed time. But all it really means is in the course of time. So we have no idea. There's nothing that tells us how old Abel was when he was killed. There's nothing that tells us specifically how old Cain was when he did it. What gave you the impression it could have been 120 years?
Well, I Wikipedia'd it, and in there, whoever had provided the source information for that said that it's believed that Cain was 120 years old when he killed Abel. I thought, man, that just doesn't seem to jive with, you know, anything that I had ever, you know, I certainly never have, you know, envisioned it to be that old, you know, in confronting his brother and killing him.
But. Right. No, there's nothing that tells us. There's nothing that specifically tells us about his age. So now you've got me curious, though. So when I get to the break here, I'm going to check on do you remember what you looked up on Wikipedia specifically?
I just Googled how old were Cain and Abel when Cain slew Abel, something to that effect.
Got it.
When he killed. How old was Cain and Abel when Cain was killed by Cain? Is about how I phrased it.
All right, got it. Yeah, how old was Cain when he killed Abel? This is creation.com, Cain chronology. So this is a website, you know, conservative young earth creationists. Seth being the third name, think about 130 years. No, there's only one child, 43 years. Seth was, I guess they're, in context, Cain may have been approaching 130 years old when he murdered his brother. Thus, somewhere in that 130-year window, and likely close to the birth of Seth, was the world's first recorded murder. So that's how they're trying to figure it out. When Adam and Eve give birth to Seth and how old he was. But it's speculation. It's only speculation. You're absolutely right in saying there's nothing that definitely tells us. Thanks for listening, man. You got a great voice for radio, too. We'll be right back.
Cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I wrote The Art of the Deal. Has anybody read The Art of the Deal? One of the great books. That's my second favorite book of all time. Do you know what my first is? The Bible. Nothing beats the Bible. Nothing beats the Bible. Not even The Art of the Deal. Not even close.
Pray for the flag of the free.
Yeah, that was Donald Trump. It was just for fun. I don't plan on getting into the Donald Trump discussion today. I mentioned it briefly yesterday. The phone lit up. Everybody wanted to weigh in. We had some great calls. A lot of interesting insights from you, our dear listeners. He obviously likes what he writes and what he puts out. Look, you got to believe in what you write, what you put out. But it's kind of funny to him celebrate his book, one of the great books, right? But his favorite book is the Bible, and not even close. Second is his book. Well, I'm glad he's got a perspective on that. But I'm just curious. I'm curious. Have you read the Bible cover to cover? I'm just curious, Mr. Trump. Have you read it cover to cover? Can you tell me what books are in the Old Testament versus what books are in the New Testament? Can you, or get most of them anyway, can you recite the Ten Commandments or some of the teaching of Jesus, or tell me some of the content of Paul's letter to the Romans? Or give me some idea. Any of the 10 plagues, maybe? Or five favorite stories from the Bible or anything? Or how about this? Why did Jesus die on the cross? How about that? Why did Jesus die on the cross? I am really, really curious. Was he just playing to the crowd, which politicians do? Well, he's not a politician. Well, he knows how to be political. Does he really love the Bible? Or maybe he esteems it and cherishes it, knows it's important, but hasn't really read it. Yeah, perhaps. Good point. Perhaps he's not yet mastered the verses on humility. All right, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. In case you didn't hear this, Todd Starnes published this. This story has been out for a few weeks, but Todd Starnes has picked up on it. Came out yesterday on Fox News. The Christian purge has begun. Chaplains banned from preaching that homosexuality is a sin. Todd Starnes says this, it wasn't so much a choice as it was a demand. Chaplain David Wells was told he could either sign a state-mandated document promising to never tell inmates that homosexuality is sinful, or else the Kentucky Department of Juvenile Justice would revoke his credentials. We could not sign that paper, Chaplain Wells told me in a telephone call from his home in Kentucky. It broke my heart. So please understand this. He cannot minister to these kids anymore. He cannot minister to these incarcerated juveniles anymore because he could not sign a statement in harmony with biblical teaching. He would have to say that he would never tell an inmate that homosexual practice was sinful. So if he's got some guy struggling in that prison, in that jail, and he's talking to him, and this person says, is it wrong? You know, I want to have sex with my boyfriend. It's a guy. Is that wrong in God's sight? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But Jesus died to forgive that sin and to give you a new life. No, you cannot say that. Kentucky. We could not sign that paper, Chaplain Wells said. It broke my heart. So the Kentucky Department of Juvenile Justice revoked his volunteer credentials as an ordained minister, ending 13 years of ministry to underage inmates at the Warren County Regional Juvenile Detention Center. 13 years. This is not the kind of thing you do to get rich and famous. This is not the kind of thing you do to build up your ministry or your church. This is the kind of thing you do because you love people. Maybe you were in trouble one day. Maybe someone you know got in trouble. Maybe you just have a heart for these kids, many of whom were raised in hellish environments. And they hardly know their dad because their dad spent most of his life in prison. What a great outreach. What a wonderful thing to do. What a great place for the gospel. A juvenile detention center. No, you cannot get in there unless you sign this document, limiting your ability to teach what the Bible plainly says. Superintendent Gene Wade said this in a letter to Wells: "We sincerely appreciate your years of service and dedication to the youth served by this facility. However, due to your decision, based on your religious convictions that you cannot comply with the requirements outlined in such and such, such and such, such and such, regarding the treatment of LGBTQI youth, I must terminate your involvement as a religious volunteer." That's outrageous. That is outrageous. And notice buying into these multiple categories: L, G, so lesbian, gay, B, bisexual, T, transgender, queer, which is either a Q, which is either queer or questioning, and I, which is normally intersex. Sometimes I can even stand for something else in lists I've seen. Buy into this whole thing, and unless you can embrace this and throw out what the Bible says, you can't minister as a chaplain. We're not talking about some state right or something like that. In other words, we're not talking about a political issue. We're talking about a chaplain. A chaplain. Wells said that every volunteer in their church received the letter, as did a Baptist church in a nearby community. The Kentucky regulation clearly states that volunteers working with juveniles shall not refer to juveniles by using derogatory language in a manner that conveys bias towards or hatred of the LGBTQI community. DJJ staff volunteers, interns, and contractors shall not imply or tell LGBTQI juveniles that they are abnormal, deviant, sinful, that they can or should change their sexual orientation or gender identity. Wow. But hang on. If you believe you're a boy trapped in a girl's body, that's perfectly fine to tell them change your gender identity. But if you say, "I'm struggling, I'm biologically male, I feel like I'm female, I need help." No, you can't help that person be who they were born to be. No, you cannot. Wow. Wow. And to say that homosexual practice is sinful, you can't say that? For years, Wells and his team have conducted volunteer worship services and counseling to troubled young people, many of whom have been abused. Wells said, "I sat across the table from a 16-year-old boy who was weeping and broken over the life he was in. He'd been abused as a child, turned to alcohol and drugs to cope. He wanted to know if there was any hope for him." Wells said he had been abused as a young child, so he knew he could answer this young man's question. "I was able to look at him and tell him the saving power of Jesus Christ that delivered me could deliver him. But under the state's 2014 anti-discrimination policy, Wells would not be allowed to have such a discussion should it delve into LGBT issues. They told us we could not preach that homosexuality is a sin, period. We would not have even been able to read Bible verses that dealt with LGBT issues." For the record, Wells said they've never used hateful or derogatory comments when dealing with the young inmates. They are defining hateful or derogatory as meaning what the Bible says about homosexuality. Matt Staver, the founder of Liberty Counsel, is representing Wells. He said the state's ban on biblical counseling is unconstitutional religious discrimination. Matt Staver told Todd Starnes, "There is no question there is a purging underway. The dissenters in the recent Supreme Court decision on gay marriage warned us this would happen." Staver said, "By restricting speech which volunteers are allowed to use while ministering to youth detainees, the state of Kentucky and the Kentucky Department of Juvenile Justice have violated the protections given to private speech through the First Amendment and the Kentucky Constitution." Staver said the policy requires affirmation of homosexuality as a precondition for ministers providing spiritual guidance to troubled youth, and singles out a particular theological viewpoint as expressly disfavored by the state of Kentucky. An absolute outrage. State Senator Gerald Neal, a Democrat, dared Christians to challenge the law in court. "I'm just disappointed that the agendas by some are so narrow that they disregard the rights of others. Let them sue and let the courts settle it," he said. Wow. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Edgecombe, Maine. Joseph, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, hi, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
Hello. Oh, I'm sorry, did I call you Dr. Brown?
Yeah, you did. That's fine.
Okay. I was just listening to you for about a half hour now, and there are a lot of hidden things that started a long time ago in this country. I am a firm believer in our Lord Jesus Christ. I'm a member of the Calvary Church. I've studied the Bible and trying to make heads or tails of what's going on in this world. I'll try to give you a quick reflection of my life in the past. I had gotten sick late in my 30s, mid-30s to late 30s.
Let me jump in. We got a break. We'll resume with you getting sick in your late 30s. Want to hear what you have to say. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire. Michael Brown here, 866-34-TRUTH. All right, back to Joseph in Edgecombe, Maine. So you wanted to just very briefly, obviously we're short on time, but give your own journey.
Go ahead. There's a lot of connection to what you were saying before, in reference to the gay issue and all of that. But, you know, I put the pieces of the puzzle together over a long period of time. I had been ill for quite a long time. Mm. And the Orthodox doctors, they could not help me for some reason. And I had all kinds of tests and everything. I was diagnosed with WPW, which is Wolff Parkinson's White. It's an arrhythmia, a heart arrhythmia. Your heart beats. Mine was clocked at 280 beats a minute. I had to get what they call an ablation to, you know, knock a lot of it out, correct it. Later on, I had all these other symptoms and everything else. I switched milk and went to soy milk, and then I found out it took a while, the downfalls of soy. And you can find all the information. As far as soy goes, it's a terrible thing for children. There are two ingredients in it that are toxic. I have reams of files on the soy. You can
I know you've been through the ringer. We just have to.
A child, and you can get a hidden uterus and stuff like that. So when these people say, "Well, you know, they're born that way," I have found there's always a culprit. There's always something. And then later on, I had all kinds of other symptoms, and I found out over 10 years ago there was something going on with tooth fillings with mercury in it. This is a biggie. This has been going on for 150 years. The symptoms are horrendous. They are horrendous. I couldn't prove it. The courts, so they have a gag order on all this stuff. So I went to a biological dentist. They said, yes, it is. I tried to find proof. I studied biology. I mean, I've read books about these things. Hard to believe that this is going on in this country.
Right, so what you're saying is that there are things that are part of everyday life in America, be it diet, be it medical treatments, that have adverse effects on us.
On us, yes.
And those adverse effects can include various diseases, breakdowns in our body, and perhaps even things having to do with perception of gender or, you know, hormone issues or something like that. You know, Joseph, first, I'm sorry you've been through such trauma over these years, and it can be terribly frustrating. I can't imagine. And I do hope that God's grace and strength is sustaining you now. But look, thank you, sir, for calling and opening up about that. I just want to run with what you're saying, but thank you, sir, for the call. I appreciate it. Okay. I wonder, with certain hormonal issues and certain struggles people have, or masculine, feminine questions that come up, if certain things do relate in any way to our environment, meaning what's in our diet, what's in our foods, so on and so forth. Everything can influence the body, the mind, you know, what you eat, what you drink, the environment you live in, different things like that. So For example, I'll just give the most simple, basic example that's common sense, is when we would go minister in India. I've been there 22 times in the last 22 years. We go there, we'd sometimes go into the tribal regions, and the people there were much smaller than your average Indian. And the reason was that they don't have proper nutrition. The water, different things like that. There can be pollution. They get sick in different ways. Their bones don't develop right. So we know there are certain physical consequences, right? The problem is when you now try to tie that in with a behavior. In other words, I'm attracted to the same sex because of what I eat. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I want to identify in a certain way because of diet. No, I don't think so. Now, could it be that certain things tie in with a mother's diet and the hormone bath, as it's called, or the children get in the womb and so on? There are all types of complex issues that can come up. Obviously, here's the deal. I'm responsible for my behavior. I'm responsible for my behavior. I'm responsible for my actions. Even if I'm born with certain propensities, even if I'm born with a propensity towards violence or propensity towards sexual lust or propensity towards lying, and human beings are born with all kinds of sinful propensities, we're still responsible for our behavior. That's undeniable. And as followers of Jesus, God will give us grace to overcome. So just like someone who's born blind and has a real severe handicap, they can learn to function in this world and be productive citizens in this world. And as believers, if they're not miraculously healed, and the vast majority are not, then, at least historically, God can give grace for that person to be blessed, productive, and overcome that handicap, even without the ability to see. So whatever is going on, God's grace is more than sufficient. That's one thing. The second thing is, yeah, I agree with the comment just sent over to me. Our spiritual and mental, emotional diet is going to affect us a lot more. In other words, what do we watch on TV? What do we watch online? What do we download? What do we ingest that influences the way we think? I want to encourage you to ingest my book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution. You will read it through, and it will impact you. It will open your eyes, but it will inspire you. The book is not gloomy. Oh, no, it's all over. What are we going to do? No. The evil gays are taking over the world. What are we going to do? No. This book will give you a heart of compassion. This book will make you understand that we're not going to change anything by demonizing people or vilifying people. We're talking about neighbors, friends, coworkers, where there's evil, where there's wrong, where there's sin, whatever it is in society. We overcome evil with good. But this book will give you principles. Okay, just basic. Here's how we live. Here's how we live as a family. Here's how we conduct ourselves. Here are the stands we take. Basic principles for long-term cultural change while showing you, wow, stuff you never would have dreamed of, page after page after page, what is happening in our society and why it is so critical that we take a clear and definite stand. When you order the book through our ministry, exclusively through us, you also get a free copy of my two-hour debate with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach as a homosexuality, America's greatest moral crisis. It was done at Southern Evangelical Seminary, and we've gotten great, great responses for years to that debate. And my answer was no, homosexuality is not America's greatest moral crisis. Lack of consciousness of God is, but it's the greatest threat to freedom of speech, religion, and conscience. Go to AskDrBrown.org to order. My bottom line today, while living by what is right, we have the surefire formula to outlive what is wrong. Oh, society is in upheaval around this, but I want to talk to you about how to outlast the gay revolution.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
She told me, she's like, it's not an option. Like, it's a demand. That's what your job is. There are times where they would just take what they want. And these mothers don't know. And there's no way they would know.
That is a clip from a former procurement technician, Holly O'Donnell, former blood and tissue procurement technician for STEM Express, a startup biotech company from Northern California that partners with Planned Parenthood clinics to purchase their aborted fetus parts and resell them for scientific experimentation. Video number 6 in the continuing expose of the evils of Planned Parenthood. We're going to broaden our discussion, not just talk about outlasting the gay revolution as we did in the first hour, but outlasting cultural demise in general. A culture of life trumps a culture of death. This is Michael Brown. You are listening to The Line of Fire, your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity in the midst of a society in chaos and a church all too often in compromise, but a society, I would say, that is recognizing, at least when it comes to abortion more and more, some of the evils of what we're dealing with, a society that more and more is recognizing that it's heading in a wrong direction, and a church that little by little is waking up from its compromise. 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. I was sent an email from a staff member to link to a six-minute video from an excerpt of a message by Matt Chandler, Pastor Matt Chandler, talking about the evils of abortion and making a strong case for pro-life. We posted it this morning, so nine or so this morning, so 6 hours ago, and it's already reached over 358,000 people through our Facebook pages, and your Facebook page has been shared over 4,300 times. These things are hitting a nerve. These things are hitting a nerve. And as they hit a nerve, light is going to shine on darkness. Now, let me lay something out very basically about the culture of life and the culture of death. And if you're listening to me and you've had an abortion, we're not throwing salt on your wound. If you've never come to Jesus and asked for forgiveness for the sin of abortion, God only knows the mental and emotional state you're in when you went through with that difficult decision. But if you've never asked for forgiveness for the sin of abortion, I assure you, Jesus died for that sin, just like every other sin. And if you ask him for mercy, he'll have mercy and forgive you. And that means that from there on, since he paid your debt, you now belong to him. But living for him is the wonder of all wonders, the joy of all joys. If you have been forgiven, don't beat yourself up and say, Lord, make me an ambassador of life. Help me to bring life and to bring grace to others, and to help those who want to make wrong decisions. Everything with God can be redeemed as we give our lives over to him. But you see, if you don't have a culture that esteems marriage, that esteems children, the culture begins to die. Under communism, which celebrated abortion and denigrated marriage, the population rate started to drop so dramatically that the communists had to aggressively push against abortion and for marriage. Talked about it a couple weeks ago, stuff that was documented by Bishop Fulton J. Sheen and then discussed by Professor Paul Kengor in his book, Takedown. So we see around the world, the population rates are too low, that you need on average 2.1 children born to every woman during her childbearing years. And without that, society can't make it. It can't sustain itself. We're in that state many countries around the world today. We need a culture of life.
Give us strength to always do what's right. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
In a sense, it kind of redefines backroom abortion. It used to mean illegal abortions, but now that abortion is legal, we have opened the door on what really happens in the back room.
That is the voice of Charles Krauthammer, respected journalist and TV commentator, saying, yeah, the whole thing. Now we're going to have safe. Everything's going to be safe, safe abortion. It's all going to be safe. Everything's going to be good. Planned Parenthood, abortion clinics. Hey, now the atrocities just get multiplied. Now, you know what it's like? It's like instead of strangling people, we're just gassing them. Instead of strangling them one at a time, which can get messy. Instead of that, we are just gassing them all in a gas chamber. So instead of, you know, backroom abortion, maybe the woman dies too. Now we just slaughter lots and lots of babies with our great clinics, and then we sell the baby parts for profit. That's what we're dealing with. That's what the monstrous evil we're dealing with. I just saw a question that was posted for me on Facebook, and 99.9% of these I'm not going to see or certainly see during a radio broadcast or certainly be able to respond to on a radio broadcast. But there's a gentleman whose comments I'll see from time to time that virtually always disagrees with me, but I guess listens regularly and asks a question. So in deference to your regular listening, sir, with your constant disagreements, which I appreciate, I want to respond to your question, because I talk about the Lord burdening me to write or to speak. And I've been asked, what does that mean? It's a foreign concept to the listener. Well, there is a biblical concept of having a burden, where something is cast on you like a weight. For me, I am moved. I'm stirred. I must speak. I must act. I must address this. I am gripped in a life-giving way, not a negative way where it is a negative burden, but a positive burden. I must say something about this. I must do something about this. Let me give you a for instance. Let's just say that lots of kids in your neighborhood were coming down sick and no one knew what was happening. And then you actually, through investigation, found out that there was some person who had been hurt by the town and wanted to get back at them, and he was poisoning the food supply, and these kids were getting sick, okay? And you found, you gotta make it known. You gotta expose this guy. You gotta let the law know about it and save these kids from getting sick. Well, it could be that abortion, you never really thought about it. And suddenly your daughter's going to have a baby and she sends you a picture of the ultrasound. Daddy, look, you see it's a boy. Or look, you see, it almost looks like he's waving. And you think, we abort those. I got to do something about this. So I feel something emotionally. In my heart, in my mind, I feel something that rises up in my spirit that I have to speak, that I have to act, that I have to do something about it. And it's from the Lord that he wants me to, and therefore I address it. I get grieved by things. I get hurt because I see other people getting hurt. I see a need, and I know the need needs to be addressed. I believe I have something that will help people. I see an attack on our freedoms of religion and speech. I see people being demeaned. I see misunderstanding, and I'm burdened and gripped to address these things. Hence, I speak of having a burden or writing out of a burden. Just like something is physically thrust on you and you're now carrying that on your back, a burden, right? Well, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, I'll feel something thrust on me. The way it's put scripturally, when God was dealing with the prophets of old, to use that as an example, the lion has roared, who can but fear? The Lord God has spoken, who can but prophesy? Amos 3. As I said yesterday, I'm not God's policeman. I don't go around looking for error to confront and to fix this, downloading everybody's sermons from the famous preachers in America and surveying the latest books to see who's teaching something I differ with. No. This has to be something that comes knocking at my door. Maybe I run into it everywhere on Facebook that people are dealing with the same issue or error. Maybe it's something that I see or I hear that I'm grieved over or burdened. Maybe I know that there's an antidote and a solution, and I've got to get that out. And that's how I've written many, many of my books. Five volumes on answering Jewish objections to Jesus. I was burdened to do that because I was watching other Jewish people who didn't know Jesus, who came to faith in Jesus, being pulled away by rabbis and talked out of their faith by rabbis. And I thought, I've got to help them. I have answers. I can help. So I spent years of research and writing out of that burden to do that. When I wrote Hyper Grace, I was terribly burdened seeing the negative effects of this doctrine, an exaggerated message of grace, an unbiblical message, or a message that goes beyond Scripture, mixes beautiful, wonderful truths with serious error. I saw the effect it was having. I was jealous for biblical grace. I felt burdened to write the book, and therefore I wrote. Now, I don't write everything under the same level of burden. I'm writing a commentary on Job. I love Job so much. And after teaching it once at a seminary, I got to write a commentary. I got to devote years to this and write a commentary on it. That's a different kind of burden. That's just, I love this. I'm consumed by it. I want to study it and get the message out. But there are other things I feel like they're life and death. No, not that I'm the man. I don't think I'm the man. I have a role. I have a role. It's a big body with lots of people. I have a role. I have a job to do. But I feel a burden to do it with excellence. I feel a responsibility. I hear from people who literally, they'll say, this message has saved their life. They'll say, Dr. Brown, you saved my life. Well, I didn't. It's the message of the gospel that we brought, or the truths that we were able to articulate from the scriptures. But when we read these story after story after story, people helped, people transformed, we know that it's sacred and essential work. So I hope that explains a little bit more what I mean by having a burden. Let's just listen to a little bit more from this former worker who was, again, her name, Holly O'Donnell, former blood and tissue procurement technician for STEM Express, which bought aborted fetus parts from Planned Parenthood to use and resell for scientific experimentation. We'll go to clip number two. And she's talking about the environment within the Planned Parenthood clinics, this type of setting. She's talking about that environment there. Clip number two.
Fresno was in actually an alley. The areas like Fresno where it's dirt cheap and the area is not good. There were so many. I would work for 8 hours and there would be 40-something patients. It really wore me down. It's the environment, it's morbid. Like, you can feel it. You can hear screaming. You can hear crying.
Yeah, talking about inside the clinics. Oh, wonderful abortion clinics. You say you work there. You stay in there hours and hours and hours. You see and experience all kinds of things. So listen now as she gets in detail about fetal specimens, baby parts being procured one way or another. We'll skip over to clip number four. Listen to what she has to say.
The fetus, the fetal tissues remains is a POC, which stands for product of conception. So then I would wait for certain girls to come in. I would look for an opportunity to consent. So that would mean, like, after they go in, they get registered to nurse, go sit down. That would be a great opportunity for me to, hey, can I talk to you for a second? Come in, shut the door. STEM Express had a consent form. We'd have to initial, you know, I certified, I'm donating, I know I'm not going to be reimbursed or compensated, I know this is for disease research, I've already consented that I am going to get an abortion. Yeah, no, that doesn't happen all the time. The coworkers I had, they would not consent the donors. If there was a higher gestation and the technicians needed it, there are times where they would just take what they want. And these mothers don't know. And there's no way they would know.
You get that? Do you understand that? That she is claiming that co-workers of hers if they needed a baby in more advanced development, higher gestation, they needed some fetal tissue, some of the products of conception, they needed these baby parts, they just took them. They just took what they wanted. And the mothers didn't even know. Okay, I may not have enough time to play some of these clips. I'll play some more when we come back. But listen, friends, a culture of life, a culture that esteems marriage, that esteems family, that does not look at children as a punishment or a negative, that esteems life beginning in the womb, will outlive a culture of death, will outlive a culture that minimizes life in the womb, that downgrades the importance of children. The culture of life will outlive the culture of death. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
They come in, they do a test, and then you find out they're pregnant. Then you can consent them. So pregnancy tests are potential pregnancies, therefore potential specimens. So it's just taking advantage of the opportunities.
Did you get that? So woman comes in, pregnancy test, that could be an abortion, that could be more fetal tissue. Take advantage of it. Do your best. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to clip number five. And let's hear more from video number six, exposing Planned Parenthood.
So I consented her. And she said no, and I'm fine with that. I'm not going to press anybody. I'm not going to consent a girl who's throwing up from the abortion medication. That's not who I am. And she said no, and the next day, Jessica came, and she's like, oh, the high gestated girl, do you have to get her, make sure you get her? I'm like, oh, I already consented her yesterday. She's not comfortable. And she looked at me like, okay, walked out, took her into the room, and she came back out, and she was holding all these tubes. And all I said to her was, what do you say to her to get that blood? And she's like, nothing. I'm like, so basically you just went in there and took her blood, and you're going to be taking her fetus without her knowing.
Yeah, uh-huh. These things happen according to this testimony, and none of it would surprise me at all, given the greed that's out there, given the amount of money that can be made, given the dehumanizing of these babies. Just a couple more clips. I want you to hear it, and then we need to pray for Planned Parenthood to be fully exposed and for America to repent of the grave sin of abortion. Clip number six.
Didn't know a lot about Dr. Berman, this other than he worked for Planned Parenthood. There were actually comments made about him. He had a reputation for going viciously fast. Like, if we didn't watch him, we would lose our specimens. It was that fast. If there wasn't a girl in the room, he would get mad. He would pace the hallways if there wasn't something to do. Like, it's almost like he wanted to do it. And that made me really concerned.
Look, there are former abortion doctors, former abortion providers, nurses, abortion clinic owners that talk about the method of how to get it, more babies aborted, more money in. And now with this revelation of the trafficking in body parts, this does not surprise us whatsoever to hear. And then all these horror stories of women who are mistreated or who suffer consequences, and they're not told in advance that this could hurt them. They may not be able to get pregnant in the future and things like that. No. Oh, it's compassionate. Right. There may be some who are misguided in their compassion, but there are plenty. This is big business. One more clip. Clip number seven.
The women I worked for were cold. It's cold. They don't care. They just wanted their money. They didn't care that the girl was throwing up in the trash can, crying. And even there are times to when patients would ask me, like, they would come in and be crying, like, should I do this? Should I be doing this? And, like, from my personal view, I'm very pro-life, and I would tell them, like, run, like, go. Like, you'll figure something out. You don't want to do this. Like, if you don't want to do this, go home. And I would get in trouble for that. I get in trouble. Jessica would say, why don't you consent her? Like, because she was crying and throwing up, and she didn't even know if she wants to get it done. What'd you say to her? I told her if she wasn't comfortable with it, then I'm not going to do anything. She said, well, that was an opportunity you just missed. Like, I'm not gonna tell a girl to kill her baby so I can get money. And that's what this company does. Straight up, that's what this company does.
I'll tell you what, she was in the wrong line of business, huh? That is not the line of business you want to be in if you're pro-life. She thought she's just procurement and so on. But look, friends, these are the realities. These are the realities. This is what is going on. May God continue to shine his light and expose the darkness. And I want to give you an opportunity. We had some very moving, stirring calls in the last few weeks as we focus more on this with the Planned Parenthood sting operation videos coming to light. If you have your own story to tell others, a story of caution, a story of warning about an abortion in the past in your own life, give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH. Give us a call and let your story bring redemption and help to others. Let your story be cautionary for others, or perhaps how the Lord ministered grace to you after an abortion. 866-34-TRUTH. One more thing, and then I'm going to change subjects in terms of what I'm going to be talking about. Someone wrote to me and said, look, the actors, the people who were involved in the sting operation with Planned Parenthood, they had to lie about who they were in order to do that. Is it right? Now, obviously, this woman, Holly, is just talking about her own experience after having worked there. And if she's saying these things truthfully, if she's saying these things honestly, again, let the truth come out. I have no reason to doubt her. I don't see how this is going to help her in saying these things. But you have to say if, because I'm not there. You're not there to verify it. It's her story. Although I trust it. But someone had said the sting videos. That meant someone had to lie to get that information. How is it that Christians could use these? The best example I could give is this. If during the days of the Holocaust and the world denying what was really happening, if you were able to pose as some German Nazi doctor who was checking on the operations, or some German gas technician who was checking on the operations in order to document what was happening with the slaughter of Jews and others under the Nazis, would you have been wrong to do that? If you could have exposed that slaughter to the world and helped the world recognize what was going on and help bring the war to a speedier end and liberate these prisoners and shout it out for the whole world to see, to further create an outrage against what the Nazis were doing, would it have been justifiable? If it was justifiable for Rahab the harlot to lie to save the lives of the Israelite spies out of fear of God, if that was right, if it was right for the Hebrew midwives to deceive in order to save the lives of the Israelite baby boys, if these things were right then, would it be wrong today for someone to do that to save lives? That's how I look at what's happened with these Planned Parenthood videos as well. It is to save lives. It is to expose a monstrous evil that is taking place. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. I'm also going to take your calls on other subjects on that are not related to what we've been talking about. Be sure to check out this week's special resource offer, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, together with a free 2-hour debate that I did with my friend Rabbi Shmuley. We come back, I'm going to go right to the phones, 866-34-TRUTH.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. Swinging into different subjects now, some of the news items I want to discuss. But first, we'll go to Philadelphia. Sahim, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Dr. Michael Brown, how are you, sir?
Very well, thank you.
It's good to hear from you. I have most of your books on my bookshelf, the five-volume series, Answering Jews' Objection to Jesus, the Real Kosher Jesus, etc., and well-written, and I appreciate it, Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, thank you.
Now, my question. In Stephen's speech, according to Acts chapter 7, when Stephen begins recounting Jewish history, according to the anti-missionaries, he makes a couple errors in his recounting, or maybe Luke, through transmitting, made an error as far as it was 75 instead of 70, the purchase of the field by Ephron the Hittite, where it was supposed to be Shechem, the son of Hamor. And also, you know, the patriarchs being buried in Shechem when, according to, you know, Jewish writings, it is buried in Hebron. And I was asking you questions about that. You know, is it, does Stephen make different errors? I mean, I've been doing my own little reading, but I want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, sure thing. First, I appreciate your interest in having the books and your pronunciations of the chets and things like that. I don't always hear that, so that's sweet. I'll pronounce it as Stephen, as you said, Stephen, but... as more common in English. But yes, it's a common claim that in his speech in Acts 7, as he's recounting history, that he makes a number of mistakes. Now, number one is not a hill I'm going to die on, because all I need to know for the Bible to be inspired is that Luke recorded it accurately. In other words, he's getting up, says filled with the Spirit, he speaks. Doesn't mean every word he says is infallible. So if in fact he made some errors in his speech, in this pressure-packed situation, if that's the case, it doesn't prove anything, because it's not the proof of the inspiration of Scripture. It didn't say that he spoke infallibly. Our view is that Luke recorded it accurately. So, for example, when you have the speeches in the book of Job, as the people are contradicting each other, Job and Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and they're contradicting each other, it doesn't mean that each thing that each one of them says is perfectly accurate. So first thing, I diffuse it right there. But the best answer is that there are answers for each of the specific points. For example, in some cases, he's just following a different textual tradition. We know that at the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that we have preserved in Hebrew texts that reflect the Septuagint tradition. In other words, times when the Greek translation seemed to vary from the Hebrew Bible, and we didn't know why. Well, now we have manuscripts in Hebrew saying the same thing as the Septuagint in some of those verses. The same with what's called the Samaritan tradition of the Pentateuch, that there seemed to be some differences in some readings, but now we have Hebrew traditions going back there, saying, in other words, that just like we have different manuscripts of the New Testament today, and you have King James following one set of manuscripts and, say, the NIV following a different set of manuscripts, that you had the same with the Hebrew Scriptures in ancient days. And so when it comes to the 75, there was the Septuagint tradition that we know, and the Septuagint tradition, instead of saying that there were 70, it says 75. So this is just another ancient Jewish tradition. And James Kugel, one of the leading Jewish biblical scholars in the world today, a scholar in Hebrew poetry, wrote an article saying that it seems that there are other things that Stephen is referring to, either merging two accounts together or giving other background that goes back to extant Jewish tradition that we have witnessed in other documents. So it's not so much that he spoke in error. And if he did, that wouldn't faze me anyway, because what's inspired is Luke's recording of it. But it could well be there was no speaking in any error, that he was just following different Jewish traditional viewpoints. And I'll give you a couple other examples when we come back. Stay right here. But thank you for a great question. Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, your listener-sponsored voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. In Volume 4 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, Volume 4, Answer 5.2, I get into some depth about Stephen's speech as I'm speaking to Sahim in Philadelphia. So I just want to take you through a couple of things in that section, specifically with regard to the number of those that went down with Joseph into Egypt. So Genesis 46:27 says the figure is 70. So 66 plus Jacob, Joseph, and Joseph's two sons. The reading in Septuagint doesn't include Jacob and Joseph, but includes nine sons of Joseph, thereby arriving at 75 souls who went down together to Egypt. And Exodus 1:5 in the Septuagint and Dead Sea Scrolls, 4Q, so the fourth Qumran cave, Exodus A at 1:5. So in Hebrew, it also says there were 75. So you have ancient Jewish traditions that draw from that as well. And according to Professor James Kugel, he said, much more could be said about the exegetical background of the speech. Indeed, a thorough treatment of the subject could, without exaggeration, fill a book. The angel who spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, Acts 7:38, law delivered by angels, Acts 7:53, and a great many other of Stephen's exempla might likewise be shown to reflect other well-known exegetical motifs. In other words, ancient Jewish traditions that were similar to what Stephen recites there that were well-known in the Jewish world. So, for example, Acts 7:14 through 16, that allegedly says that Stephen got things wrong with the burial traditions. Professor Kugel says this, all this to say that in however garbled a form, the references in Acts 7:14 to 16 to the removal of Jacob and our fathers reflects a substantial body of already existing extra-biblical material. Our fathers refers specifically to Joseph's brothers, whose bodies were removed before his, but sometime after the transfer of Jacob's last remains to Hebron. Indeed, it is certainly significant that the same phrase, our fathers, occurs in the Qumran document that he had cited, which is 4Q545, Visions of Amram, apparently in the same sense. In other words, while you might say, man, Stephen made all kinds of mistakes, it would be unlikely for Luke to then record them if they were so error-filled and an embarrassment. Rather, Stephen was citing other well-known Jewish traditions as well. And that's the best way to understand it. And you'll see parallels in other ancient Jewish literature. You'll even see, for example, in Mark 6, there's a quotation from Isaiah 6, but it doesn't follow the Hebrew. It follows the Targumic tradition, an ancient Jewish paraphrase. It would be just like a preacher preaching today and quoting from the New Living Translation to bring a point out, or I quote from the Living Bible to bring a point out, even though that's not an exact translation of the Hebrew or Greek. The same thing went on in the ancient world as well. The last thing, Sahim, is that the counter-missionaries are guilty of dealing with unequal weights and measures because they know full well that throughout rabbinic literature, there are far more severe, quote, errors than what's found in Acts 7, but those are excused, whereas ours are kind of nailed to the wall.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah, I've got a quick question for you. If I recall, because it's not everyone who has the name Sahim, if I recall when I was on with Dr. Michael Heiser last week, you called with a question about the Hebrew verbal system, but we couldn't get your call. We ran out of time getting to calls that day. Does my memory serve me correctly?
Exactly. That's exactly what happened.
All right. Hey, if you want to ask the question, we can give it a shot even on Wednesday.
What, you want me to call Wednesday?
No. I'm saying it's Wednesday. It's today. It's not Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, but if you want to give your question a shot, I'll try to give you a quick answer.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, my question about the Hebrew verbal system, I've been studying the Biblical Hebrew since 2008, mm-hmm. and my question was, what's a good way, or is it material where it can help me better comprehend Hebrew verbal stems, like identifying it. Is this the PL stem? Is it the Pu'al stem, et cetera? And I'm having a slight difficulty, even though I got familiar with a lot of Hebrew words and I can, you know, basically read it fluently straight through, but identifying certain Hebrew verbal forms and conjugations still to this day give me problems. And I want to know, you know, do you have any, you know, points to make or any, you know, way it can make it easier for me as far as the Hebrew verbal system?
You know, a lot of it, first, you know, God bless you for making the effort. A lot of it is just familiarity. You keep reading it and reading it and reading it, and it becomes more and more familiar, and you get used to things. There are certain rules. If you've used a good biblical Hebrew grammar, it will tell you certain things to look for. So, for example, when you see a dagesh, so the dot in the, for others that aren't familiar with the term, the dot that's in the letter, and it doesn't seem to be a good reason for it, that means there's a doubling that went on, right? So if the doubling doesn't make sense, maybe another letter dropped out, like a nun dropped out, and that's why this is doubled. Sometimes you can identify things by that, but they're just patterns that you get used to. When you have a vav at the beginning of a word, and now, or excuse me, a yud at the beginning of a verb, like yalad, to bear, give birth, and then it becomes in the hifil, the causative form, it will become howlid. This would be a causative form of the verb. You say, well, how did it get from a yud to a vav? Because originally it was a vav, and that reappears. So, I mean, certain things you just get used to. It's like, ah, when I see that vav there goes back to a yud. A lot of it is just repetition. Is there a particular Hebrew grammar that you've studied and used?
I have a bunch of different sources. Off the top of the head, I use the first Hebrew Primer. I also use Basics of Biblical Hebrew by, I might say his name wrong, Pratical, I believe that's his last name, mm-hmm. Van Pelt.
Mm-hmm.
I also use Jeff Benner's book, the first Hebrew series. And,
yeah, that one you'd want to avoid. That one's not going to give you accurate information in many ways, unfortunately. Yeah, so that yeah, you want to avoid. In fact, I may even give an example on it on the broadcast tomorrow. Yeah, so the best thing to do is, I'm sure you have charts and like the Gary Practical book, just keep going through the charts. And then as you keep reading it, more and more things will become familiar with. But for anyone, there are going to be things here and there, because the Hebrew Bible is often complex and difficult, that you don't get. They baffle you a little bit. So you have your dictionary in hand, and then you look at it. The other thing is, there is the cheating way with software, that when you hover over the particular word, and it'll tell you, okay, it's this verb, it's this root, it's this conjugation. And then from there, it's like, okay, now I've got it. The best thing to do, though, let's say you do that. Let's say you hover over the word with your software, and it tells you it's this root, it's this conjugation, right? Now what you want to do is click on the dictionary entry and look at all the examples. And see, not try to memorize each one, but see how it works. So by repetition and by seeing large numbers of things is going to be the best way for you to get grounded there. Hey, thanks for your efforts. Keep working at it. I learned modern Hebrew in college and taught myself Biblical Hebrew using Thomas Lambden's Biblical Hebrew Grammar. And I remember having worked on that and memorizing every form. And Rabbi just gave me a little rule one time. He said, doesn't it basically work like this? I thought, oh, man, that simplifies it. So sometimes you learn those along the way. But thanks for the call and your efforts. Keep pressing in there, buddy. 866-34-TRUTH. Changing topics dramatically, we go to Jacksonville, Florida. Harold, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I was listening to your show yesterday.
Yeah, and by the way, just to say this quick about Donald Trump, that that in point of fact, there are many polls now, or other polls indicating that he did take a hit after the debate, which is what I would have thought. But anyhow, many were explaining why Trump is so popular, and he still is very popular. Yes, so back to you.
Okay, so I was shocked to see that there were so many people calling supporting Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't take it so, you know, too hard. I'm a Hispanic male living in the United States for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I guess I'm biased subject, but, you know, I assume that the majority of the callers, you know, are Christian. So my question is that when you go out to vote, is there like a separation of church and state when you're thinking about it? Because a lot of them said that Donald Trump is expressing what they've been thinking.
Yeah.
I
tell you what, let me give you my comments on the other side of the break. But Harold, when you identify yourself as Hispanic American and maybe biased, all of us are biased. I mean, all of us have our own viewpoint. So that's going to happen with all of us. All of us have a way of looking at the world and things, and that's going to be, you know, we do our best to be honest and fair, but we're all biased somehow.
Fire we want, for fire we
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right. A few comments, Harold, in response to your point. And then, friends, I want to get to two more things before we're out of time. So, first, separation of church and state, of course, does not mean that we as Christians separate ourselves from society or that we don't vote. Our nation as a democratic republic was based on the idea that there would be a strong Christian presence and a strong foundation of belief in God at the root of our operations, and that as we voted, that would be the strength of the country, as we voted as God-fearing, moral people. So separation of church and state means that the state imposes no religion, that the state cannot impose a religion on the nation or restrict the activities of religion within the nation. So by all means, we should vote as much as we're able and get involved. And if we don't, we have ourselves to blame. The idea we're in this world and not of it means we don't partake of the world's evil and we live by a different set of values, but it doesn't mean we don't participate in the society as much as we can. And if there had been the opportunity to vote in ancient Rome, as if it was not the kind of government that it was, led by a dictator, if that was not the case, and if you were able to vote people in, then of course it would have been a right to take advantage of. That being said, why would Christians vote for Donald Trump? Now, some were just saying why they think others like him and why others are supporting him. But for sure, some were saying it speaks their language. It concerns me in that I don't know what his moral values would be. I'm not confident that he would stand for the unborn, that he would stand for marriage as God intended it. I don't know that. I believe he wouldn't back down from anything he believed was right, and perhaps he could really help with our economy. And sure, you want a leader that's going to be strong-headed, but you also want someone that is going to display a bit more humility and a bit more recognition of the dignity of others and things like that. So obviously that concerns me. If he ended up being the Republican candidate and I had to choose between voting for him and Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, obviously I could not possibly vote for the Democratic candidate given their platform and given the candidates that are out there. Could I vote for Trump? If God laid it on my heart that he was being raised up for a purpose, even though he was not a godly man, or if I felt that his views were deep enough that he could stand for things I wanted, stand with Israel, then I potentially could, despite other things that would be very off-putting to me. But that's a big if. These are all big ifs. And I appreciate that many Christians could say, under no circumstances could I vote for him for various reasons. But thank you, sir, for the call. I do appreciate it. Okay, two things. I've been asked by a good amount of people about the Hillsong situation, Hillsong New York, Hillsong International, stances on homosexuality. Look, these are brothers and sisters. I'm rooting for them. These are people who want to see Jesus lifted up, even if some of our methods and approaches may be a little different, some of our theology a little different. We're not talking about lost sinners, heretics. Some of you may think they're heretics. Just be careful. Be careful with how you throw the term around because it may come right back at you, okay? But some say, look, they're just lying. Face the fact they're lying. Face the fact that we have been lied to, because I always try to give the benefit of the doubt whenever I can. So, yes, it's true that Brian Houston, Nightline, makes reference November of 2014 to a gay couple singing in a choir in the church in New York. He makes reference to that to say everybody's welcome. Even a sing in the choir? Yeah. Then, was it December, this couple on reality TV, they come out, they're going to, quote, be married. And then, from what I understand, since then, they weren't involved in any ministry or leadership positions within the church since they came out and said that. And then Brian Houston, in a statement released last week, said he was shocked to find out about them and what was going on. Some people say he's obviously lying because he knew about it, spoke about it in November of 2014. So I see three possible answers here, and I continue to withhold final judgment. And it's not my role to sit around and give my opinion on everything that's happening, but this is very public and concerned a lot of people, and we had reached out to them, so I am trying to address it. In short, I see three possibilities. One, he forgot. He forgot that he knew it and was shocked later on to find out. One possibility. Can it happen? Yeah, it can happen. Is it unlikely? Yeah, but just giving possibility. Possibility number two, he lied. He lied. That's a bad one. He's an international leader, highly respected. That'd be possibility number two. He lied. Hope that's not true. Possibility number three, that as long as they were a celibate couple, that he had no problem with them saying that they're in a relationship, but they're not sexually involved and they're not, quote, married. They're just really, really close friends. I'm stretching it, but whatever. And he knew that. And he said, yes, a gay couple sings in the choir, but it didn't mean they were sexually active. When he finds out now that they're planning to, quote, get married and be sexually active, well, no, that's wrong. Now, I understand the whole thing would be wrong. But perhaps that was it. That as long as they weren't sexually active, then it was an issue. Once they were, then they couldn't be involved. Anyway, you ever sat with people and counseled one person and they tell you their story, think, man, you're right, and then there's no answer for the other person. The other person comes in the room, give their story, they're like, you're right. How did these work? I guess one's lying. And then they sit down and both put them together and say, oh, that's how they fit. So until we know more, that's where it is. T.G. Jakes, again, his official statement yesterday, he understands how I did find it defensive and even attacking unnecessarily, but he does say this: my beliefs about sexuality and marriage is with all topics based on Scripture, 2 Timothy 3:16, God's inspired word. I firmly believe that marriage is ordained by God as a union between a man and a woman, Ephesians 5:31. My stance on the topic has never wavered. It is fixed, steadfast, and well documented. Nor am I ashamed of the gospel for fear of appearing politically correct. It is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes. I believe that all sex outside of that sacred union is sin, and that would include, but it's not limited to, homosexuality. I use Romans 1:24-29 and Hebrews 13:4 as the scriptural basis for what I believe. I believe in the transforming power of God's word. It is the ultimate aim of truth. I also believe in balancing that truth with grace so that the word becomes the personification of Jesus Christ, his love, mercy, and compassion. And he goes on from there. He said, my hope is that the church will always be evolving in how we address, administer to the LGBT community in ways that are in line with our biblically based beliefs without losing sight of Christ-like compassion. So I do appreciate him making that statement plainly. There were a lot of questions. There was a bit of an uproar. I do appreciate him doing that. And I've shouted that out as loudly as I could, Facebook, Twitter, to say, hey, here is his statement, since I asked for clarification. Now, there are other questions I did have that maybe at some point there'll be further clarification, maybe the ability to dialogue with him and other leaders about these things. But it's interesting. It's interesting. And again, I may write on this tonight and post it tomorrow. It's interesting nonetheless that he's still a friend of Oprah and she's still friends with Joel Osteen, even though both of them on her network have said that homosexual practice is sinful, or that marriage is the union of a man and a woman. So maybe you can say that without being a homophobe? Could it be? All right, check out our special resource offer at AskDrBrown.org. My bottom line today: the culture of life will outlive the culture of death. Let us live, let us thrive, let us celebrate life beginning in the womb.